Welcome to I Might Believe in Fairies. I am your host, Aaron Erber. This is a podcast about stories, myths, and the Catholic faith. Hey everybody, welcome to I Might Believe in Fairies. Today we are going to be discussing the book. It just came out, It came out in 2019 from Angelico Press. It's called Beneath the Silent Heavens. And it's by an author named Brian Christopher Moore. And today with me to discuss the book are people, two guests who have been on this show before, Jonathan Geltner, and he discussed his book, Absolute Music, that came out a couple years ago from Slant Books. just remember that. And then I have Gregorio Montejo, who was our R.A. Lafferty expert. So he and I talked about all things R.A. Lafferty. And he is coming out with In a Green Tree, which is a semi-autobiography of R.A. Lafferty. And it's about a million pages long. So I don't know if you guys want to say hi. You know, you can go into more of an introduction if you want. So whatever you guys want to do, Jonathan, if you want, you can start if you want.
Hi, yeah, sure, Aaron. Thanks for having us on to talk about Brian's book. I guess I would start since I'm sort of responsible for this thing being published partly. But did you want to say anything first, Gregorio, before I launch into?
No, go ahead. I'll introduce myself when I start actually talking about the book.
Great. Okay, so I thought I would briefly relate the history of this book and my acquaintance with Brian Moore, the author. I've never met Brian personally, like in real life, flesh and blood, face to face, but I've known him for years virtually online. I met him or made his acquaintance through a blog, which is still active, called Eclectic Orthodoxy. It's run by Father Aidan Kimmel, who's an Eastern Orthodox priest, retired, a Western guy. I think he started out Episcopalian. Anyway, it's a great website. There's tons of excellent theological, aesthetic content on his website, mainly theological, but he gets into literary matters. And I was a regular commenter there back in the 2010s, like the, I don't know, maybe say around 2014 or so, in the years around then. And Brian Moore was also a regular commenter on that blog and even published a few things on the blog, as did I back then. And we got to know each other that way. In fact, it was through that, the correspondence that started up through that with Brian, that I can take the dubious credit for introducing him to R.A. Lafferty, who will probably come up again later, the great American author of speculative fiction, 20th century author. Brian, like myself, is a huge fan of Lafferty's novel Ocklahanally. But he's also, though, I think his favorite Lafferty novel that he's read, or favorite book by him, is Arrive at Easter Wine. So, Gregorio, if you want to discuss either of those maybe in a bit, that could be appropriate to this specific book of Brian's and just sort of his overall sensibility. Brian is a very learned guy. He has a PhD, I think it's in English, from University of Dallas. Very learned in theological and philosophical texts from all over the Christian tradition and just sort of generally as well, secular philosophy, the modern period. And he has a very good literary sensibility. As you can see from this book, I'll mention some influences in a minute. The story of how it came to be, I learned from him in one of our email exchanges that he had this manuscript that had been lying around for a few years, I think. And at the time I was in conversation with John and Kari Reese, who are the publishers of Angelico Press. An excellent press, I would highly recommend. So along with Eclectic Orthodoxy, which I recommend, I also recommend Angelico Press, all of their titles, anything they might publish. John and Kari Reese are very cultured people, excellent editors. I was in conversation with them because I was getting ready to do a translation of Paul Claudel's Five Great Odes. And I basically pitched Brian's book to them. My one and only act so far as a literary agent, and they decided to publish it. I'm very happy about that because Brian deserves to have his work more widely recognized. And I think everyone that I know of who has read it since then has been really into it, really, really pleased by it. I think Brian himself doesn't regard it as like the capstone of his writing or as his mature work, which I think he's wrong about. I think it's quite brilliant. No need to belittle it at all. But in terms of his influence, so there's kind of a couple ways that we could contextualize Beneath the Silent Heavens. You can talk about it in terms of the influences that Brian himself is conscious of. He's one of these writers who will give you a bibliography along with a work of fiction. This is not maybe as uncommon as people might think, but as I mentioned, he's very learned and is very conscious of a lot of different influences and is trying in a lot of his writing, whether it's this novel or if you read some of his essays that have been published or read his Substack, he's referring to and drawing upon a lot of different sources. So if you ask Brian himself, who he's conscious of as an influence, he would talk about quite a lot of people. I already mentioned R.A. Lafferty, who's a bit obscure. There are a few other rather obscure literary authors who have been very important to Brian, including a number of poets. So he's not a poet, Brian, that I know of anyway. I don't think he's written any verse, but as any good writer is, he reads widely in all genres of literature. And so he's a huge fan of David Jones, who was an Anglo-Welsh Catholic convert, a modernist poet, wrote some very challenging experimental poetry in the early and mid-20th century. Very rewarding stuff, very rich stuff that has a lot to do with the mythos of Britain, with Arthur and the Grail, with elements of both the sort of Celtic pagan sensibility and mythology and the history of the Roman Empire and the presence of Rome, particularly in ancient Judea at the time of the events of the Gospels. So that's a major influence for Brian. David Jones, who had this vivid historical imagination, and though he was working in poetry, not in prose, was often trying to give us fictional presentations of events from sacred history. There would be many others to mention: Hopkins, Charles Piggy, T.S. Eliot, Yeats. I know that Brian is also a great admirer of Faulkner and of Cormac McCarthy, a great American literary author who died just over a year ago. So he certainly reads in the literary fiction as well in its tradition. But by far, I think the greatest influence on Brian, and I could mention other authors like Gene Wolfe, Brian has definitely read and admired a great deal, particularly the Book of the New Sun. But by far the greatest influence is C.S. Lewis, I think. And behind him, of course, George MacDonald. Brian is a great fan of MacDonald's fiction, but also of his sermons, his theology. C.S. Lewis is definitely the major influence in Brian's early life, I think. And he's written that he's particularly, he gives just one instance of many he might from Lewis's work, that he loves the end of the last battle. And he thinks of it as a depiction of epictasis, this theological notion from Gregory of Nyssa, that that the experience of the divine is not static. It is an infinite adventure, basically, infinitely creative. Tolkien also, and other influences. So Tolkien also, and Charles Williams would be other influences of Brian's work that, that you would detect resonances from their work in Brian's. I think that what Tolkien has to say about the nature of what he calls subcreation in his essay on fairy stories would be much in tune with Brian's approach to writing, and evident in a lot of what he writes. That's about, I mean, that's, I'd say that's about it in terms of major influences I would mention to help us contextualize the book. The other way to go about this, though, is to talk about things that, you know, Brian's not necessarily conscious of or thinking so much about in a work like this. So one of the reasons that I was so impressed by the manuscript when I read it and wanted it to get published, if I could make that happen somehow, is that I've long been interested in fiction that takes for its starting point something from the Bible. Even more than, like, say, wonder tales or miracle stories of saints or something like that, but specifically the Bible, that takes something from sacred scripture, sacred history, sacred story, and transposes it into the world of fiction, and then builds on it from there, reimagines it, which is what Brian's book, Beneath the Silent Heavens, effectively is. It's a vast reimagining of the short episode in the Old Testament of Noah and the flood. Brian builds a great deal around this in the novel. So I'm really interested in fiction that does that. And or that seems somehow deeply inspired by the Bible. There's a lot of really interesting questions that this kind of writing raises in terms of the status of fiction, what its truth claims are, as over against the kinds of stories that are told in scripture. There are contemporary, so it's not terribly common anymore to see this, and yet some of the best writers are doing this kind of thing in modern and contemporary fiction. I already mentioned Faulkner and McCarthy, who there are very strong biblical resonances in their work, but even contemporary authors, I'm reading right now with the purpose of writing on the Norwegian author Karl Ove Knausgård, many of whose novels, but particularly his most recent ones, are an imagining of biblical events, Old Testament events in some of his earlier work, and now the apocalypse in his novels that are being published right now in English. And this is literary fiction. This is not like rapture, genre fiction or whatever that stuff was from the late 20th century. This is a contemporary literary author and one of the most masterful. The Norwegian author, so his countryman, another Norwegian author, Jon Fosse, who just won the Nobel Prize, he is a Catholic convert. Comes from a somewhat religious background in Norway. He has very strong biblical resonances in his writing. So it's a thing that does happen now. It's not completely impossible to find. But of course, historically, there's some hugely important examples. The most obvious one in English is Milton, Paradise Lost, and what is seldom ever read alongside it, although it should be, the much shorter Paradise Regained, which is about Christ. So Milton is our great example of that, the possibility of taking a biblical story and expanding it hugely. I recently was rereading The Divine Weeks by Du Bartas, this Renaissance French author. It used to be a more common thing to do. And you go back even further than the Renaissance into the Middle Ages, and you have something that I don't know actually if Brian would be too aware of it or not himself, but it seems to me to stand at the sort of beginning of this tradition, the morality and mystery and miracle plays of the late Middle Ages. This was a kind of wonderful genre that I wish we could revive it somehow. We don't tend to give much attention to these things anymore, although every now and then you get someone like Hofmannsthal, who he has a play called Jedermann, Everyman. This is 100 years ago. Every now and then you get someone who's into these things, but it's pretty rare. These were wonderful pageants, these sequences, cycles of plays, dramas, little dramas that were put on in the late Middle Ages all over Europe, but definitely quite a lot in England. We have a lot of Middle English miracle plays, mystery plays. And this is, you know, taking the biblical stories from all over the Bible, Old Testament, New Testament, all different episodes from it, and reimagining it, or just trying to literally imagine it, make it visible, make it an image. So this is an ancient thing. This is a tradition. This mm-hmm. is not like some goofy thing that like a modern fantasist would think of. there is some real precedent here. And of course, you could go back into antiquity, and you know, there's all kinds of or early medieval stuff. You know, you get like versions of the gospel told, and as if it's like an old English epic or a Greek epic. You get it in hexameter, you get it in old English verse. So there's always been this sense in various different Christian populations that the stories of the Bible, and there are so many, I mean, because you can break it down into little sequences, little episodes, and any one of those episodes can become an entire book, as we see in the case of Brian's work. You know, Genesis alone has like dozens of them, and you know, you take any of the Gospels and break it down into the core episodes, many of which form like moments in the liturgical calendar. You can look at it that way too, but there's always been this sense that these stories are available for reimagination. And I would say that actually, if those stories are still alive, if the Bible still has power to persuade people of its truth, then those stories would have to exhibit that tendency, namely to get picked up by authors of imaginative literature and spun into sometimes very different material, but nonetheless definitely coming from an attitude towards those biblical stories, which takes them not just at face value in terms of their dogmatic truth, but as a sort of raw material of mythos. And that they need to be that in order to be true as sacred scripture. So there's this really fascinating interplay going on here between the category of scripture and the category that we now think of as literature or creative art. And Brian's book is part of that millennia-long thinking about the relationship between those two categories. And I would say that it is by and large a very Christian activity. It's not, it can be done subversively, and there are people, you know, who have tried to do this, and I think I didn't actually read it, but I think Colm Tóibín had some version of the Passion story or a gospel or something that had a kind of not exactly traditional take on like certain of the figures there, Mary in particular. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, this has been done with, I would say, good intentions. And you know, you still get like Milton didn't have the most orthodox theology, but it doesn't really affect the result, which is that the Bible continues to be this living repository of story, and that we need it to be that in order for it to continue doing its work. So Brian's book is participating in that, both consciously and, like I say, unconsciously. There are authors working today that Brian's not that into, as far as I know, who are also feeling the potency of biblical imagery and stories and continuing to turn that into imaginative literature. Anyway, I think I've rambled for quite a while, so get it in now. I'll just mention that Brian Moore does write a Substack called Christ the Symphonic Adventure. And in that title, you have that notion of epictasis, the idea that divine truth is like Rome, is like a romance in the literary sense. It is this never-ending adventure, or never-ending story, to quote another fantasy by a Christian author. It is alive. It's still working. His writing there is very philosophical. It's a little more on the philosophical side of things than fiction. At least it has been so far, but who knows what he'll put up in the future. Anyway, I'm well and truly done now. So,
all right. Well, thanks, Jonathan. Gregorio, why don't you introduce yourself?
Well, I've never had the pleasure of talking with the author of this book. I haven't read any of his essays, so I came to this book completely fresh. Okay, I didn't know what to expect. In fact, if you hadn't invited me to participate in this podcast and then therefore read the book first, I might never have read the book. Mm-hmm. It would have been a tragedy. So I have to say thank you very much to you for introducing me to the book, and thank you to Jonathan for being an advocate for its publication. My background is in medieval theology. I got a doctorate in historical theology at Marquette, focusing on patristics and medieval theology, and more specifically on Aquinas. I ended up doing my dissertation on Aquinas in Christology. And I taught for many years at various colleges, universities around the United States, beginning with the University of St. Thomas in the Twin Cities. And I ended up, my longest tenure was at Boston College, where I had the privilege of teaching both undergrad and graduate courses in medieval biblical interpretation and other aspects of the medieval theological tradition. So I have to tell you that since I don't know Moore or his other writings, that's the way that I contextualized his book. And as I started to read it, within the first five pages of it, I said, gosh, this reminds me of those medieval mystery plays.
Yeah.
And I said to myself, well, am I crazy? Is this for real or not? So I kept reading it. And after a while, I said, nope, this is a medieval mystery play.
Hmm. Yeah.
And of course, Jonathan mentioned several of the cycles that were done. So that there was a whole entire series of these plays. And they usually went from Genesis all the way to the apocalypse. And one of the favorite topics was, of course, Noah and the flood. So Noah figures prominently in a lot of these mystery plays. And one of the things you notice in all of these Noah plays is that the folks who created and played these tableaux were not only interested in giving you, a word-for-word representation of the biblical narrative, but they wanted to present it in some ways as if it was a contemporary narrative, if it was a story that was as relevant to them in that period as it was to the time of Noah. So you get this interesting back and forth where you'll have something directly taken from the Genesis text, and then you have a scene where Noah and his wife have a marital spat. and his wife says, "No, I'm not going to go in the ark. Are you crazy? I mean, I've got all these things I need to do, and my friends are beginning to laugh at me, and they're talking behind my back, and I don't want to leave my friends behind, and so forth and so on." It's something that humanizes Noah and his wife, and you can imagine that happening to a couple in the 13th or 14th century. But beyond that, as I read further, I saw that Moore had really imbibed something deeper than just the superficial trappings of the medieval mystery play. And I think the best way to characterize it is a kind of typological or figural imagination. Now, if you study anything having to do with pre-modern theology and the Bible and so forth, you're introduced to typology in a kind of a probably not too deep way, but typology was basically the way that Christians read the Bible for many hundreds of years before the advent of historical critical methodologies. And typology says that rather than being a collection of heterogeneous texts or two testaments that are only imperfectly connected with each other or that are difficult to discern how one fits with the other, typology allows us to see that there's an intricate and organic and deep connection between the two testaments. And what typology does is it says that the Hebrew Bible provides a promise that is fulfilled in the New Testament, okay, with Christ being the central figure that gives life to these promises. Now, it does not allegorize the Old Testament. It doesn't say, well, these Old Testament figures and these Old Testament stories are only significant as just abstract symbols pointing towards the future. It says there is something intrinsically, organically true happening there, and that we should read these narratives for what they tell us. But there's a supplemental, there's an additional, there's a deeper meaning that is only uncovered in the future with the coming of Christ in the church and so forth. So there's promise and there's fulfillment. I'll give you an example of how medieval Christians would read a biblical text typologically. Adam, let's take Adam in the Garden of Eden. Adam falls asleep. God comes and he takes the woman from his side. And someone like Tertullian, for example, who had a huge influence on the entire medieval period, says the sleep of Adam points forward to the sleep of Christ, which means the death of Christ. And so the taking of the woman from the side of Adam, the patriarch, should be paralleled with Christ on the cross, and he's wounded on his side, and from his side comes the water and the blood, which is the birth of, in some ways, the emergence of the church, of Mother Church. So Eve, the mother of all men, emerges from the side of Adam in his sleep. Mother Church emerges from the side of Christ on the cross in his sleep of death. Okay, that's a typological reading. Okay, it doesn't belittle in any sense what it tells us about Adam. Okay, the significance and the importance of Adam remains. But now we have an added dimension to what happened to Adam. Because the full significance of what God was doing with Adam becomes evident with Christ. And interestingly enough, the events of Christ can then be read back into the narrative of Adam, and that can add an extra dimension to when to that narrative. So next time you read the Genesis story, if you're familiar with Christological, typological readings of Adam, now Adam becomes, he has a dimension that he lacked before. Okay? So there's another interesting thing here, which is the temporal, dimension. The medieval conception of time, which is not our time. Okay, we're used to sort of linear time. Events go in one direction. A causes B, B causes C, which causes D, and so forth and so on. Everything is always moving in one direction, time's arrow. What the typological imagination invites us to do is to see that these two events separated in time, which are not directly connected in one temporal dimension, affect each other, influence each other. And that this influence works both ways. It works from Adam towards Christ, because Adam is pointing towards Christ. But it also gives a kind of retrospective meaning to the story of Adam as well. So you see that time actually also works from the future backwards. Okay? Why is this possible? Well, it's because it's time seen from the point of view of God. And for God, time is laid out like a giant tapestry, complex tapestry in front of him. And so he can see the entire tapestry, whereas we cannot. And if you can see the entire tapestry, you can see how all of the web, all of the threads connect with each other in ways that you can if you're actually in the temporal flow. Once I sort of gleaned onto what Moore was doing, that he had been at least influenced, or he had read some authors, or he had picked it up in his education, then the other mystery which confused me when I was first reading the book began to sort of clarify for me. And that's the question of when is this narrative happening? Okay, is it happening in the time of Adam, or is it happening in some sort of nebulous, quasi-modern place where it seems like the Industrial Revolution has already begun? Okay, so that's kind of blurred. And also, there's discussions of quantum mechanics and all sorts of things which are beyond even the scope of this sort of generic Victorian vibe that you get sometimes from the narrative. So it seems to me that what Moore's doing is he's actually laying out the entire scope of the story, both as it happens in the biblical narrative, but also pointing forward to Christ and beyond, to ourselves, and then backwards, retrospectively, so that the story of Noah now becomes even more meaningful and deeper than it would have been if we just read the biblical narrative. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. Well, that was a big question I had too. Is like, when does the story take place? And because it does feel like you have cameras, you have, you know, at least the beginning of the story, and then as the story progresses, you get more modern technology. I don't think it ever progresses to the point of cell phones or anything like that. But you have like grocery stores and downtown areas and things like that. And yeah. One thought I had when I was reading it was, you know, during the before the flood, you have this idea that the Nephilim are present in this novel, but you have this idea that the Nephilim, or these fallen angels, the Nephilim are a product of them, but these fallen angels can give technology, you know, to people. So it's like there's this theory, you know, it's kind of this weird online theory, but there's a theory that's like, well, the technology was super advanced right before the flood, because of all this, you know, and that was contributing to the overall decadency and sinfulness of the people.
It's not just a contemporary internet meme, though. It actually goes back to the intertestamental literature.
Yeah. Right. No. I'm saying like not that the Nephilim in theory is a online meme, but like, you know, the more fringe elements would be like, oh, they had technology comparable to ours. You know, they had like genetic. They might have. I don't know. But that's one.
If you read something like the Book of Jubilees or First Enoch, then one of the themes that runs throughout that is that Enoch, who was Noah's great grandfather, in that entire family was in contact with the Nephilim, and that there were both evil and good Nephilim, and that the good Nephilim taught Enoch all sorts of technological knowledge that was denied other humans at the time. And that the Nephilim in particular taught Noah the arts of healing, so that he had ways of medicinal knowledge, esoteric knowledge of the workings of plants and so forth to heal people. And I think there's a kind of, you pick that up in more as well. Isn't Noah a kind of healer? Isn't it pointed out that he has special powers to heal?
Yep.
And he's got that knowledge. There's also the ability to speak with the animals.
Right.
That's another thing that kind of interweaves through some of this intertestamental literature, that Enoch and his progeny were allowed a power that was already being lost to the other human beings, and that one of these powers, that because of their contact with these celestial beings, was this ability to understand the primordial speech and to be able to speak and converse with the animals. So that also impressed me quite a bit, beyond just the medieval aspect, is that it seems that Moore has read deeply in either the original sources or some other scholarly accounts of all of this speculation that raged among the rabbis and other scholars in the immediate decades before the arrival of Christ.
Mm-hmm. Well, then it connects to when you drink the blood of a dragon, you get the speech of birds, from Siegfried fighting the dragon, in the Germanic folk legend. And I think that I don't know how it connects, but I think it kind of fits the theme. And there are dragons in here, and there are other things as well, like the salamander, which is really interesting. That's why I wanted to find that book before we had this conversation, so I could at least read what, Louis... Oh, I'm terrible at pronunciation. Louis Charbonnet-Lassay, in his Bestiary of Christ, what he had to say about the salamander. And the salamander features in here, and it's in medieval and probably earlier maybe in like alchemical works, but in medieval symbolism, the salamander was like immune to fire, and it was a symbol of fire. And in the book, in Beneath the Silent Heavens, there's a tigress character. She goes to find the salamander tree, and that. As I'm thinking, why is it a salamander tree? And when salamanders are connected to fire, I'm like, is there some connection to the burning bush here? The salamander is immune to fire, and the burning bush was, did not consume itself in the flames, which is also an image of Christ. And then the salamander is also an image of Christ himself, and its purity to resist the flames of like lust and the worldliness. So I think there might be something going on there too. With the salamander tree. And then I don't know what to make of the owl. I only got a little ways into the animal symbolism, but there's a lot of animal symbolism in here.
There's the owl of Minerva.
Yeah. That's kind of what I was thinking. Yeah.
Mythology is this embodiment of wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
No, and I think that what impressed me is that this typological undercurrent that you begin to see even from the beginning of the novel becomes more pronounced and more powerful as the novel reaches its climax. I'm thinking of the from around page 240 on, where Noah's in his final quest to arrive at the rainbow, to arrive, I guess, at regeneration, at purgation. If we take the analogy with the baptismal waters seriously. But in his journey, which is a kind of a spiritual itinerary, which also reminded me of some aspects of medieval theology, St. Bonaventure and so forth. Also, I noticed that he mentions Teresa of Avila's interior castle very briefly at one point. I couldn't help but think, oh, he must have read some Lafferty of Teresa of Avila.
That scene specifically reminded me of Fourth Mansions. Yeah. I got very, especially when he's being... when Noah is being questioned by the psychiatrist and he thinks he's just another crazy person, and Fourth Mansions that happens to the main character too. Exactly. And I'm like, okay, there's obviously this connection here, you know, between Fourth Mansions is my favorite Lafferty I've read so far. It's very, very good.
I wasn't aware that Moore was a fan of Lafferty, but I immediately, you know, I'm so besotted by Lafferty immediately. But just to finish the thought on typology. So there, as we come to the climax of this journey, we see things like he encounters the three magi, and it says it reminds him of his three sons. So the three sons of Noah point forward to the three magi, and then he comes to the stable in Bethlehem, and there's a kind of beautiful poetic image where the stable in Bethlehem with its animals is conjoined stylistically, poetically, through the image to Noah's Ark, full of the animals. And there is a mention of the Ark of the Covenant. So the Ark of the Covenant and Noah's Ark are both these wooden vessels that are constructed to bring God, God's goodness, God's grace, God's creation. And then he meets the woman at the stable. She has given birth. And her last lines is she identifies herself as the new ark.
Yep.
She's the new ark, the covenant. And what she has given to is Yahweh. She has given birth to Emmanuel, to God with us. So that's on page 244, 245. When I had been increasingly impressed by the book and overwhelmed by the power of the beauty of the writing and the depth of the ideas that he was working. But I have to admit that when I got to that page and the woman identified herself as the Ark of the Covenant and the way he just brought all those Ark themes together, it really kind of blew my mind. It sent a little shiver down my spine. And I said, this Brian Christopher Moore is a genius. You know, he's just such his mind, the way his mind works, it's just wonderful.
Yeah. Why? So one of my questions was, why is this female character called Absinthe? You know, I was doing a little bit of research on like Absinthe, and you know, it has this hallucinatory sort of effect, and it's green, and she's got green hair, and I don't know what to make of it. You know, there's a lot in this book that I've read it twice now, and I obviously this book requires a lot more than just two reads. But
Also Absinthe is French, but it comes directly from the ancient Greek absinthos, which is the word for wormwood.
Oh.
So if you read your Bible closely, you know wormwood is always associated with great bitterness.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps most dramatically in the apocalypse, where the star or the angel falls called wormwood into the water and it turns the waters bitter.
Mm.
So I think Absinthe is the first Eve. She she basically says, I am the mother of all these children.
Yeah.
And Noah sort of is taken aback and says, well, my wife is going to be kind of surprised that you're the mother of my children. But of course, she means she's Eve. She's the mother of all men. But there's a duality to Absinthe. He says there's something glorious to her and there's something dark simultaneously. So there's something bitter and there's something sweet to Absinthe, to the first Eve. And I think the sweetness comes from the dignity of the fact that she is, the first of God's creation, the first woman, and so forth and so on. But she's also the vessel through which sin came into the world, and the fall and death, which is in some ways the ultimate bitterness. And so that tension between the bitterness and the sweetness, the glory and the darkness of the first Eve Absinthe doesn't get resolved in the novel. I felt it as a growing tension within myself as I read along, and it kept bothering me. Mm. And I said, this novel can only really succeed for me if this duality is somehow explained or resolved in some dramatically powerful way. And so I point back to the new Eve when she calls herself, the Ark, the new Ark of the Covenant. So the second Eve redeems and removes the darkness from the first Eve by giving birth to the second Adam, which is the way that typologically, Christ and Mary were read in relation to Adam and Eve.
Mm-hmm.
Moore is very much steeped in this pre-modern way of reading the Bible, and he uses it beautifully, very poetically in this, at the resolution, the climax of the book.
Yeah, that makes it a lot clearer to me. One thing that, so we talked about influences, and since I did not know he had read Wolfe too, it's good to know. But the Three Kings, the Magi scene was very, that struck me as very much a scene right out of Wolfe, you know, the descriptions of the Three Kings and their different personalities, like that, it was very, very Wolfian to me. And it just, the seeming randomness of it too, you know, and like, which isn't really random. Like you, as you said, it kind of, parallels his Noah's three sons. And they each have a different reason for visiting, trying to find Christ, right? Which I thought was a nice touch, because we don't really get that in scripture. In fact, we don't even get the fact that there are three magi at all in scripture. It just says, you know, magi. But traditionally there are three, and they're from, you know, different parts of the world, and they're all looking at the signs in the heavens, you know, which is another pre-modern thing as well that we don't really do much nowadays. And I was kind of thinking as I was reading that, like, I'd like to learn more about, you know, what is it, not astrology, you know, without the weird stuff, like the New Age stuff that comes along with it, you know, like, I'd like to learn more about how they viewed things and what things would mean to a pre-modern people. But it's really hard to, you know, get into that without all the, you know, weird stuff that comes with it. But that would be a project for some, you know, enterprising person. I also was thinking, as I, you know, was looking at different bestiaries and stuff, and like this book, I'm like, this, I think it's time to revive, like with the medieval plays, you know, like revive the bestiary tradition, like of, you know, writing bestiaries and how animals and plants point to Christ. Just, that was just kind of my thought. I'm like, maybe I could do that. I don't know. I don't, that'd be fun. I don't know what I would need to do to put
I
into that.
Affected, but... by the way, he used the animals.
Yeah.
They're heraldic, they're symbolic, but there's also a core importance and integrity to the animals and themselves and to their relationship to nature,
mm-hmm.
which I think goes towards healing the sort of purely instrumental, mechanical, modern view of animals and natures. It's sort of just a product that we can exploit for ourselves, and that animals have no integrity or value or worth beyond what they can provide for us in material terms. Mm-hmm. So I was very, very happy the way that he used animals. The tiger was very important. Let me just, because I think we should definitely, or I would love to discuss the centrality of Peggy to I think Moore's project. I would love to bring Jonathan back in here. I know he's read widely in French literature, and I think he could say quite a few things about Peggy and his function in this novel. But before we do that, I'd just like to touch upon something which was both affecting and tragic to me at the end of the novel, and goes back to this idea of typology. So at the very, very end, almost as a coda, we have this very short chapter at the very end of the book, and it's sort of narrated by Shem, mm-hmm. who's one of Noah's sons. But he says, oh, and by the way, now here I'm living, and I'm familiar, I'm in conversation, I'm friends with this guy named Abram, and he knows me as Melchizedek. Okay. So here the typology gets really deep. Okay, so Melchizedek, the king of Salem, is known as an archetype, as a figure of priesthood.
Mm-hmm.
He brings a sacrifice not of animals but of bread and wine, and he points to the ultimate high priest, to Christ, who instead of animals, who instead of mere wine and bread, offers himself as the final ultimate holocaust, as the final sacrifice. And there's a note of sadness in Shem Melchizedek, because he says, after we went through that journey, after all we learned, after the flood, we left the ark, and Noah for all his virtues, went back to the animal sacrifices.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and remember that animal sacrifices almost upends the entire journey earlier in the novel when the snake points out to the other animals that Noah, who's going to present himself as kind of the savior of the animals, you know, sacrifices animals. He kills animals on a regular basis to sort of appease his god. And Shem says, oh yeah, Noah went back to sacrificing the animals after he had saved the animals, after he had lived with the animals, after he had understood the animals, even though he could converse and understand the animals, he went back to killing the animals, you know, ritually, sacrificially. And Shem says, but my sacrifice, where the animals are no longer killed, but it's now the sacrifice of the bread and the wine, points forward to a better sacrifice, a greater sacrifice, an ultimate sacrifice, the sacrifice that will actually accomplish what our sacrifices can only attempt to do, which is the final reconciliation of creation and God. And I thought that was a wonderful way to end the novel.
Yeah. Well, then, see, that also says sin. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Jonathan.
I think there's a bit of René Girard in there too, understanding the efficacy at last of Christ as a sacrifice, the sacrifice that is finally effective, takes the place of the older order of sacrifice. But sorry, go on, Aaron. What?
I was just going to point out in that same section, much the same point you guys are making, that the flood did not, I think it said the flood did not excise the evil from man's hearts. You know, it ultimately failed because they still brought the evil with them in their own hearts, much like Ham's evil in his heart. And the bull that he sacrificed was the one who spoke up for Noah, right? He advocated for Noah in front of the other animals. And it's actually like the scenes with the animals, you know, is heartbreaking, you know, like he was able to capture so much emotion with the animals, like with the babies going missing, and you know, the second time it happens, you're just feeling the dread. You're like, oh no, it's all happening again. And with Manwise, the bull, the fact that Noah could not hear, he did not know Manwise's thoughts anymore. You know, he couldn't read his thoughts, or he didn't know his heart or something like that. And Manwise, trusting Noah, but when he saw the knife, fear entered him. You know, and then Ramir, the tigress. Declared war, you know, and that was like the end of the novel. I'm like, oh my gosh, like this isn't the end, right? There's still things to be healed, and there's a reference like the journey for peace would be long in the making or something along those lines, and so it's very strong ending to the novel, and it just shows that this is, even though Noah's family is saved and you know they survived, and they were able to save a lot of the animals, there's still this problem of this divorce between man and creation and this sin that still is existent there. So, yeah. But we can talk about, I don't know much about Peggy. Is that his name? That'd be, if you guys, you can have at it. I'm interested to learn. So.
I'd be curious to know what Gregorio thinks of Peggy. And I know Brian is very fond of Piggy. The thing I would say about what you were just saying, though, Aaron, and the animals, is that I think Gregorio is absolutely right. The distinctive thing about this book and Brian Moore's imagination is that it is a medieval way of reading, mm-hmm. and then writing that is rare to encounter, although Peggy might very well be another person we could point to here, and some of the other authors I mentioned that he's influenced by. Charles Williams tried to be to some extent. I was just talking about him the other day, actually, on another podcast, and his Arthurian poetry and what. But the thing is, though, about this allegorical mode in literature is that to be truly effective, at least for us moderns, it has to work on all of the levels, including the lowest one.
Mm-hmm.
there's a tendency, it's very easy to really focus only on sort of like the higher levels of it and want to make sure that those are right, that those are sort of as grand as can be. And on those levels, you know, you have these wonderful sort of consummations of the story. You have the second Eve and the second Adam. And there's a grand closure to the biblical conception of this universe. And if we wouldn't want to lose that. But on the lower levels, the level at which we actually live our daily lives, the level of the earth, where humankind is both a part of and alienated from the rest of the natural order, you can't neglect those, or it will strike a modern reader as inauthentic, as escapist in a negative sense. And what is so effective about Brian's work, and what makes it modern and not just an imitation, a rote imitation of medieval or pre-modern writing, is I think he's aware of that. He realizes he has to do justice to the lower levels, which is to say the fallen reality that we actually inhabit in time as we normally experience it. And that, yeah, it's just an important thing to recognize about his writing. And just to note that we are indeed modern people, however much we may study and admire the work of the Middle Ages. And so when we try to revivify an older mode of reading and writing, we have to be conscious of that. And that's where a lot of modern writers might go astray. They try to, they are inspired by the medieval, the typological or allegorical, and they try to find ways of making it work as a modern genre or modern work of literature. And it can be very, very hard to do that and actually pull it off on all the levels. And so it is a singular achievement in this book.
I was just going to reiterate the point that you just made. There's a great early 20th century German scholar, Erich Auerbach, who wrote a very famous book called Mimesis. And even more important, he wrote an essay in the late 1930s called Figura, which is his defense and his explication of the figural or typological over against the allegorical imagination. And just to simplify it, his concern about allegory is that it tends to flatten things out and make them just abstract symbols. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this stands for that. And he says what typology does is that it embraces the full reality of both that which prefigures and that which fulfills that prefigurement. Even, as Jonathan said, even at the lowest levels, there's nothing about the reality that is being abstracted away. You know, the figure is there in all of its dimensions. When I read Auerbach, it made me perhaps understand more why someone like C.S. Lewis and Tolkien both adamantly denied that they were writing allegories. You know, when someone said, "Oh, when you wrote the Narnia books, Aslan is just Christ, right? It's just an allegory for Christ." He says, "No, Aslan is not an allegory." Right? He says, "Aslan is his own reality. It's his own being. He has his full, all of his dimensions, and he can be a type of Christ." He can be a figure that points towards Christ, but he is much fuller than just a flat abstract symbol.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and I think, again, to praise what Moore has done, I think he's picked that up from Lewis and from his other readings, in that he has not fallen into the temptation to make his book an allegory. It's not an allegory. It's much deeper than that.
Yeah, and that's so. For a long time, you know, as everyone knows, I'm a big fan of the author Tim Powers, who is similar to these other authors. He's different in some ways, but for a long time, I was struggling to describe what he would do in his fiction, especially like the Anubis Gates with the repeating patterns of like drowning in a river and like being resuscitated and like, you know, transmutation, stuff like that. And I'm like, well, it's not allegory, you know, it's not, you know, it's typology. What he's doing is basically typology. And once, you know, it took me a while to figure that out. But once you kind of figure out that pattern, then these other authors like Lewis and Tolkien, they make a lot more sense. You know, they you can kind of tease out what they're doing a little bit easier once you figure out kind of what typology is. Like Aragorn is you know, a type, he's a type, right, of Christ. But he is not Christ, right? He's not just an allegory. He's not just an abstraction. He is his own character in a specific setting, you know, in a specific story. But he is still a type of Christ. And so, you know, Frodo and Gandalf, and but they're not just like, you know, this stands for that, like you were saying, Gregorio. So I think typology, once you kind of figure that out, a lot of this literature kind of opens up, and you can, you know, it took me a long time to get there. You know, I think Gene Wolfe helped me get there because I really wanted to understand what he was doing. And so, you know, authors like Marco Armini would, you know, offer some help with that, you know, and explanations and things, and just learning what symbols are and what they, you know, mean in their contexts and stuff. And that's really helpful. And I think Moore is just a very good example of this sort of writing, like what we were saying. I think having that in the back of your mind, you know, like time is not linear. And this might seem trite, but like things mean things, you know, it's not just arbitrary, you know, it's life is an arbitrary thing. Things have a purpose. Like that's why those medieval bestiaries are important, because it's like their attempt to take the animal, whatever they're looking at, whatever they're studying, and try to find Christ in the divine pattern in that animal. And so they can be kind of silly sometimes because they didn't have a good understanding of what elephants were or tigers or whatever. They only heard stories, so they just look kind of ridiculous. But it's that same, it's not, it, the idea is not ridiculous. The idea is a very important thing. So I like how Brian, all of his animals really seem like they're that animal, right? Like the tiger seems like a tigress, the bear seems like a bear. But they can talk and they have personalities, but they're rooted in their own distinct species. So
yeah, you know, he talks about Gerard Manley Hopkins, the 19th century poet, and his notion of inscape. You know, Brian is very sensitive to the haikaitas, the thingness of a thing. Mm-hmm. And I think that stands behind his capacity to give very distinctive characters to the animals, for sure. The magi, as you were saying earlier.
Right.
You know, this way of reading typological or allegorical, in terms of allegory as a reading practice, it's the big thing idea is that there are multiple levels operative at the same time. But more than just that, the important thing about how this works, the reason why it's effective, is that you're as a reader, you're moving between them all the time. It's mm-hmm. not like it's not like Frozen moving in lockstep. The actual experience of writing and reading this kind of thing is that it there needs to be alternation, and it creates a rhythm and a texture to things that, from the literary technical standpoint, is really important for how this kind of thing works, so that you can be one moment reading something that seems like a high technology culture from before the flood, an mm-hmm. antediluvian high tech culture, and then another moment you might feel like you've entered a world of sort of more loftier symbols or mm-hmm. something like that. But you're always moving, and it's the transit from one kind of meaning or register, linguistic register, to another that provides so much of the energy and excitement of this kind of thing.
Yeah.
Brian's a great reader of the philosopher William Desmond, who is a great thinker of this the idea of betweenness, the metaxological, it's in the interaction and transiting between layers of reality that that human beings especially, that their consciousness, our own distinctive nature comes fully into itself. But all things participate to some degree in that metaxological existence where they're moving between one thing and another, so that you can be just your own ordinary plain self at one moment, and then maybe usually, but moments will come when you are also lined up with higher orders of being.
Yeah. I get what you're saying, and I think, not to interrupt, but I think when you're switching back and forth, this just kind of occurred to me, as you're switching back and forth between like something more earthy and something more lofty, like typological. I think what Brian does is what good authors do is when the plot reaches a climax, and I think when you're ascending that point, you know, you're the language becomes more typological as you ascend. Does that make sense? Like when it's reaching this climax, and that's when the typological language and these lofty like divine realities kind of manifest in the story. And I think it's very satisfying, you know, when that happens, because it just feels right, because the story, like the structure of the story, matches the symbolism, I guess. I don't know if that's a good way to say it or not, but I don't know if you guys thought that as well when you read this.
Yeah, Auerbach says that typology, it works because it has both horizontal and vertical causality worked into it.
Mm, okay.
What it means that is that, yes, things in this world actually do affect each other, and your choices do matter, and so forth and so on, and we live in a material world, an earthly world, an embodied world, but the things that we do also has a vertical dimension to it, because at any given moment, we're also participating in that which transcends us, whether it be a story, or a narrative, a form, a plot, and so forth. And so we're sort of also participating in a kind of an archetypal reality as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's very musical to my way of thinking.
Okay, yeah.
It's the way a musical score works. Once you get to Western music with its, you know, fully developed harmonic language, and you've got, you know, all these staves and all the instruments in the orchestra have their own part to play, and it can be arranged or just on a piano. You can just have all of this on a piano. And you've got all these levels, and they're moving at the same time. And at any given moment, maybe one or more lines of music will not be sounding, but it's still there. It's still active, and what it does is going to affect how every other note means musically. And so you've got a vertical organization between the harmony and the melody and all those different levels. And of course, the music has to actually move in the horizontal plane to happen. It needs time. Just because God's view of time is, you know, he can see all of it, doesn't mean it's not in motion relative to itself. So, it's a grand way of conceiving things. Mm-hmm. Very hard to get across, or even to talk about, because you can only write or talk about one thing at a time. unlike on a piano, where I can hit a lot of notes at once, I can only really be talking about one thing at a time, however quickly I might cycle through something. So, or write about something. So it can be daunting to imagine. If we were more familiar with musical and maybe visual architectural images or metaphors than we have become, I think, maybe we would have an easier time reckoning with a book like this. But yeah, we do the best we can with language. I really want to know what you think about the connection with Peggy, though, Gregorio. I know Brian has talked specifically about Peggy's figure Joan of Arc with much admiration, the way he uses her in several of his works. But specifically, what were you thinking with this? Was there a particular place in the book that...
I saw intimations of it leading up towards the last third of the novel. And then when the elderly Father Peggy is introduced near the end, and Noah has that very affecting conversation with Peggy in what seems to be an insane asylum or an asylum for those that society has cast out.
Yeah,
I think he was just coming out and telling us, look, this is very important to me, and I need, you need to be aware of it. So Peggy, for those who don't know, is a French poet and editor and writer of prose, who was born in late 19th century France, and ultimately died in the first months of World War I at a very young age when he was shot through the head by a German sniper in a field in France. In between that, those two events, so he packed a lot in. And in some ways, he's emblematic of the late 19th century, not just France, but you know, maybe Europe and the Western world, and that he was born in a family that traced itself back to the land. Okay, so they're basically French peasants who, you know, were tied to the land and to nature, not just because they lived there, but poetically, temperamentally, spiritually, they were of the land. And part of that tradition, part of that legacy was their staunch kind of pre-modern Catholicism, a kind of medieval Catholicism. Peggy is the first one of his family to sort of move to the city, move away from the land, and his roots are torn up, not just with his family, but with the Catholic Church. Okay, he kind of is wooed over by modernity. Okay, the materialistic, the political. He replaces the idea of heaven with a kind of earthly utopia that will be built purely through technological and political ends. And then, in the last 10 years of his life, he has a kind of an awakening when he realizes that a lot of the promises of the mechanical, materialistic, technical, political world are empty. And he begins to re-engage with Catholicism, but he's not moved by modern Catholicism. And by modern, I mean late 19th century, early 20th century Catholicism. The Catholicism that draws him back to the faith is that primeval, pre-modern, almost pre-literate faith of the people of the earth. He reconnects with the medieval, okay, and he kind of reconnects with the typological imagination. Okay? And for him, that means that the Bible is not just something that can be read dogmatically or just read through a historical critical lens or whatever the modern strategies are for reading the Bible, but that the Bible is typological, which means that the figures in the Bible and the ideas and the images and the symbols of the Bible are living and they're just as powerful and capable of giving meaning and transforming lives in his time as they were when the text was first collected. So he begins to write these long poems, which in some ways can be seen as kind of a medieval procession. And when you see these saints and these figures who embody the Old Testament patriarchs, who embody the virtues and the vices and so forth, and they're all processing and costume and stuff.
It's very much like the mystery plays.
That exactly.
Peggy's
I see.
Looked a lot like that. Yes. And like prayer, like litany.
Exactly. And he comes, another influence on him was the idea of spiritual childhood. The idea that that children are more capable of seeing the world as it is before sort of the cares and woes and of adulthood sort of strip you of your sense of wonder and imagination. So that it's easier for children to see the world typologically, but also children are the in some ways the perfect way vehicle for us to see how God's grace works itself out typologically, even in the contemporary world. So he begins to write a lot of these poems where children become the central figure. Okay, and he wrote one particular poem where the three theological virtues of faith, hope, and charity are presented as three young girls. And the youngest of the three girls is Hope. And Hope becomes, for Peggy, the most important of all the theological virtues, because it's what connects faith to love, and what allows faith to be faithful and love to be loving. And without hope, you will not come to love. At best, you will have a kind of dry faith, a kind of like, yes, I believe everything that the catechism tells me and everything that I read in the Bible, and you sort of grit your teeth and it's all just abstract, you know, words and symbols and theories and theorems and so forth. He says, no, hope is what gives life to faith, so that you're actually able to live faith, not just spout it.
Mm, yeah.
Okay. And so we come to near the end of Moore's novel, and at this point, you almost get the feeling that Noah, for all his steadfastness, is almost at the edge of hopelessness. Yes. Like everything is stacked against him. Okay, he doesn't see the light at the end of the tunnel, and it's precisely at that moment that he meets this crazy old priest called Peggy. And what does he do? Peggy is the one who loves the children that are cast out from society. He understands them. He listens to them. He can speak to them. He understands them in a way that the doctors and the nurses and everybody else who are just warehousing these kids and, you know, trying to cure them through whatever modern-day medical technologies they have available, or just treat them and keep them going. He brings them the sacrament. Okay? He brings them grace. And in some ways, they bring grace to him. And there's one particular child here in that part of the novel, Stephen, I think his name is.
Yes.
Which then becomes a guide for Noah towards the last stage of his journey. And that's basically the way that Peggy saw the young girl that embodies or typologically fulfills the virtue of hope. She's the one who's going to take you by the hand and guide you, because as a child, she has the eyes of simplicity and innocence that can see the end of the journey and that shows you hope and embodies hope. You have to be like the child in order to get to the end of your journey. You have to believe like that child. You have to love like that child. So I think that, for me, that it seemed to me that Moore was saying this is kind of the key to the novel. This unlocks a lot of what I've been trying to do with the novel, by introducing Peggy at this moment.
Yeah. Yeah, that's beautiful.
That's a great explication of it. It's true. Because, you know, honestly, I hadn't really put together quite so well as that why Peggy comes in, or, well, someone named Peggy at this particular moment in the novel. I mean, this is obviously not like a version of the actual Charles Peggy, because this is an old sick priest, which, you know, Peggy wasn't a priest, didn't live to be old. It's but yeah, that's a really great reading of this exact part in the novel. Yeah, he says, this character, Father Peggy, says some wonderful things in here. Mixing up the registers, like I said, you know, he has a way of speaking very colloquially here, but then also he'll say things like, we've stopped loving life. We no longer believe it is a good thing. And that is why the men in the city scold their loins and mothers apologize to their children for having born them into such a place. And so the language can pick up a register, you know, and it can actually sound a bit like some of Piggy's writing, maybe more his essays than, the poetry there. But, yeah, it's a wonder. You know, it's another coincidence. I think I mentioned David Jones earlier, and David Jones fought in World War I. He was the same generation as Tolkien and Lewis and all them. And one of the things that brought him to Catholicism was he was stationed in France there, and he saw a French priest saying the mass for a handful of soldiers in some barn or blown up church, or I forget exactly the location, but it was a very ramshackle sort of situation. And David Jones was kind of amazed by this very earthy, very located French Catholicism that he witnessed there, which is exactly the sort of Catholicism that that Charles Péguy, not the guy in this novel, was thinking of, in a lot of his work, and what drew him back to the church. And it would have been in practically the place where the real Péguy died. And I think where he was from too. What isn't he from, like Eastern France or?
Yeah, he's definitely from the land. He was when he went to France. When he went to Paris, he kind of abandoned
his rural roots. Yeah, Well, anyway, yes, those two figures both. And David Jones, as I had said earlier, sort of did what to some degree. Did something similar in Britain to what Péguy was trying to do, and probably would have done a lot more if he had lived in France. I guess Péguy was slightly older than Jones, but trying to find the roots of a really cosmic and Christian vision in the British landscape and the stories that were endemic there. And also in some other places, like I said, in the Holy Land, as Jones would have thought of it, as the Roman province of Judea, where he said some things historically. So Péguy and Jones both picked historical episodes to make sort of metaphysical stories out of.
Yeah, it's two great book-length poems, In Parentheses and Thaumata, both play with this idea of that the poems are set in an actual historical setting contemporaneous to Jones. So the first poem is his great World War One poem,
right,
of the trenches and so forth. But in both, those who are living out these events in present time are also...
Yeah. They're types.
they're enacting narratives and plots and stories and forms that have a transcendent meaning to them as well. So in that sense, I can see how Péguy and Jones and Moore are cut from the same cloth. I would also add Lafferty to that as well.
Yes, mm-hmm. and some of Wolfe also.
Yeah.
And that Brian has read anyway that I know of. Where you have someone acting and... the significance of their actions is not completely known to them, but
right. That's my favorite part about those authors, by the way. It's that the seemingly arbitrary things that they do actually have cosmic, significance. Wolfe and Powers. Like Powers does that too, and it's something I've recently discovered with Powers. I did a two-part essay, kind of going into Declare. And the various meanings of the name Andrew Hale and how Powers ties all of those meanings together into the character and how it has like cosmic significance and is God's judgment. And he's also, Andrew is the fisherman, St. Andrew is the fisherman. So he's fishing Leviathan, and just everything about that, when I reread Declare, I was like, holy crap, there's a lot of this in here. Like I think authors like those guys, where it's like they seem inscrutable. But once you kind of get the key to their fiction, then things will make a lot of sense. And I think there's a lot to learn from those authors, just stylistically. First off, like Wolf is an amazing stylist, and Lafferty is very funny, and also a very good writer. And I think there's just a lot to learn, just how they use those symbols and like how they use characters to kind of embody these mythic sort of tropes, just cosmic patterns. And I think more authors, I would love to see more authors kind of engage with that and try to play around with it and see what they could do. Like more is like, it's the same. He's cut from the same cloth as these guys. Like it's the influences are all there. You know, it's like this tradition. It's like its own little literary tradition of mythic sort of like mythic in the sense of, you know, not just gods and goddesses, but you know what I mean? Like this divine pattern kind of being embodied in physical reality.
I go back to Auerbach because he was born in Germany, but he was Jewish, and he barely escaped the Holocaust. He went into exile, and he wrote his great book *Mimesis in Exile* from Istanbul, where he had no library, certainly no access to medieval Christian works until he was given permission by a local Dominican bishop to come and use his own private library.
Wow.
It's full of medieval tomes. But Auerbach said something interesting. He said he identified the collapse of the typological imagination as the great crisis of Western civilization. He says that the elimination of typology, which was the medieval Christian way of not just understanding literature and poetry and art, but also just understanding reality.
Mm-hmm.
When was he connected it with the Holocaust and modernity and industrialization, and just the flattening of the modern imagination. And he said the West needed to recuperate, go back and find the typological imagination again if it wanted to save itself. Yeah. So I think we establish your Lafferty, Powers, Moore, Jones, Peggy. They're in that tradition that you've identified, Aaron. They're of the typological school.
Yeah. Well, it's the same with the Grimm's fairy tales too. You know, I've met a lot of people who they're a lot of my friends. They just normal people, kids and stuff. And I'm like trying to get them to read fairy tales. Like, read them. You know, but they're weird. Like they're weird. They make me uncomfortable. I'm like, that's good. Like do it. like try to figure them out. You know, try to just engage with the stories. And I think there's something like spiritually very healthy about them that's kind of revivifying. Because there's a Russian, Nicholas Kotar's talked about them. There's a Russian philosopher, I forget his name, but he, like the spiritual like value of fairy stories and how they can be very spiritually like healing, because they engage in my opinion, I think because they engage in these divine patterns, like the best ones do anyway. And I think there's something about that we need it. It just impersonally and in civilization, we need to have that connection to myth. Otherwise, you know, things are just arbitrary, and then you get gas chambers and, the massacre of the Cultural Revolution and all that stuff. I think that's my bold connection between, you know, if you read fairy stories, you're going to end up, you know, in a gulag or something. Or if you don't read them, you're going to be Pol Pot or something.
Well, the reason why they seem so strange, this is a new thing. I know what you mean. Now, mm-hmm. All of a sudden, people are like, oh, no, I'm not going to read fairy stories to my kids. They're weird and scary.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And this is a new development. But it's because if you're not attuned to that typological meaning, mm-hmm. to those multiple levels of meaning that are operative at once, you have no sensitivity to that. And you don't need to be able to discuss this in a literary critical manner to be sensitive to it. The vast majority of people over the last couple thousand years have not been able to do that, but they've still been sensitive to these dimensions of storytelling. But if you lack the sensitivity to the higher levels, all you're going to get is the surface stuff. And and it's really weird. It doesn't make any sense. It's disturbing. Right. It's usually gory and just all kinds of weird stuff. And so it doesn't seem like an imaginative insight into anything. It seems like the bizarre, twisted, primitive mind at work or something. But that is exactly it's very hard. It's very hard. Flattening is a good word for it. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't have much depth perception when it comes to the levels of reality that can be conveyed in story. We've taken Well, our idea of interpretation, instead of living in the text and understanding how the levels relate to each other, instead we want to take the text and use it to explain something about the world, understand it as commentary about the socio-political world that is really the only world we deal with very much anymore. And it's a disaster. It's a disaster for literary criticism. It's a disaster for writers who are stumbling through this. You know, like I said, I'm reading Nausgaard right now in his novel. The first in the trilogy is called The Morning Star. And it's dealing with this imagery from Apocalypse and elsewhere in the Bible, with like the fallen angels and stuff you mentioned a while ago. And, you know, Nausgaard is a typical secular European man of his generation. I think he's a very instinctively skilled author and very productive, hardworking author. And there's a lot to be said for him, but his education, his upbringing, you know, no trace of this typological imagination. Obviously no fault of his own, and he has that in common with millions of people, just about everybody now, unless you're weird like us and studied medieval stuff.
And, yep.
And so I read these novels and I see him obviously totally inspired and intrigued by the biblical imagery and these stories. But he doesn't really know he doesn't have access to any of this kind of thing that we've been talking about. It's not in his wheelhouse. It's just not familiar to him. It wouldn't make sense to him. And so he's spinning his own version of this, trying to understand it from scratch, basically.
Yeah.
And the thing to understand about this typological reading, or the allegorical reading method, the four layers it eventually got sort of codified into, this developed over hundreds of years with many authors, many thinkers, and writers working in a way together all over the Christian and Jewish world. It comes out of, you know, it develops there as well. As the late antique civilization and then the early medieval civilization tried to understand how to fit the Bible together.
Yeah.
You know, once you have a thing that's definitely the canonical Bible, how do you then understand how all the parts of this thing work together and build a religion around it? Modern rabbinical Judaism, just like Christianity, had to figure out how to do that. And although I'd say the task was bigger for Christians, because we have the New Testament that we need to attach to. And so it's a big process that takes a long time, or it took a long time the first time that it happened. And if something like fiction, the art of fiction, were to recreate it anew or revivify that habit of looking at literature, at looking at the world, it's going to take a long time with a bunch of people working in different circumstances, very different circumstances, from David Jones to Brian Moore. And reading each other's work, and each work is sort of a commentary on the others that the author has read. And slowly over time, if these kinds of writers can gain enough of an audience, then the readership will be trained to become sensitive to this kind of stuff again. But it takes a long time, because if you're starting from scratch, like Nausgaard is, and engaging with this stuff, it's weird. It's no one person by themselves can just like figure out how to read something like the Bible or how to create a fictional story of their own that works this way. You're dependent on the work of many generations of others. And that is not a feeling that a lot of readers have been educated into nowadays, or writers have been.
Well, that's why I'm grateful for authors like Lewis and Tolkien, because there's something we can, there are people we can point to that are doing this very thing, right? So there'd be a good way to teach people how to read in that way, because most people are at least familiar with them. You know, Lafferty and Wolfe and Powers and you know, these guys are so obscure, and they're more difficult. They're less accessible. I wouldn't say they're less difficult. but they're not as accessible as like Tolkien or Lewis, who they did the lion's share, I think, of at least popularizing this typology, you know, how to read typologically, with unbeknownst to most of their readers who don't have any clue. But like they at least they have like the a bit of a structure, I think, a framework in their imaginations if they've read, you know, Lord of the Rings or the Narnia or the Space Trilogy or whatever. They have that in their imagination, and they might not know it's there, but it's it's something that at least like there's a almost like a common baseline for people, because they are immensely popular and they still are and they probably will be for a long time. That gives me hope that, you know, we can use those authors to try to like teach people how to read the scripture in that way, and how to think in that way, and how to inform their imaginations typologically. So I think it's not as hopeless as, you know, we think, because these guys are so popular, that like I don't expect anybody to like I don't expect Gene Wolfe or somebody to like have this immense revival. I mean, maybe he will to have this immense like breakthrough popularity where everybody's reading Gene Wolfe, and I just don't think that's going to happen.
No, it doesn't need to. It wouldn't naturally happen. That's not how literary history works. There's always different levels of literature. You know,
yeah,
there's
right.
Popular romance, and there's much more complicated
right.
things, and there's no reason why they have to, you know, not everything has to be a bestseller.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. No, I don't mean to sound pessimistic about it. I think that yeah, absolutely we can learn to do this again.
Yeah.
And like you're saying, we actually do have a good body of modern writing that gives us some good primary material to right. work with. It takes different kinds of people. You need the authors who can do it.
Mm-hmm.
You need the critical, you know, the professoriate or whatever, you can expound this to other people who may not themselves become authors, but could become, you know, secondary teachers or whatever. And gradually, you know, over a few generations, it mm-hmm. can start to come together. But my point is just that it is a group effort that elapses over a long time. It's the work of a whole culture.
Yeah.
And that's one of the beauties of a book like Brian Moore's. It's so replete with connections to all these other authors we've been talking about and whole traditions of reading and interpretation that those authors were keyed into, that it's like a node, it's a focal point in literary history. And so we need to identify these kinds of books and try and get them into the hands of people who could really use them.
Yeah, no, I wholeheartedly agree. I think we're approaching 2 hours.
Oh yeah, right. I'm gonna have to go get my kids here.
Yeah, right. I need to eat some lunch. I think.
Perspective on things.
No, this has been a lot of fun. I've learned a lot just listening to you guys talk, because you guys, I'm kind of the third wheel, I think, here. Just my literary knowledge is, you know, it's not nothing, but it's not. It's also not something. So it's.
don't belittle yourself. But how did you know? How did you find out about Brian's book? Because this is valuable information.
That is. It's good to know. So Joshua Wren from Wise Blood. Yeah. He had a blurb about it. And then Julian Kwasniewski, who's the son of Peter Kwasniewski, I think wrote a review of it in the Imaginative Conservative, I think. And I mean, other people have mentioned it. I think, yeah, Michael Martin also mentioned it. And so I'm like, all right, I'll check it out. And then I looked at it. I'm like, that looks kind of interesting. I didn't, to be quite honest, I wasn't much impressed by the cover, but
I didn't choose that.
I'm picky. I'm picky about covers. But I read the back, and I'm like, okay, that looks pretty good. So I just messaged Angelico, and I'm like, hey, I have a podcast. Could you send me some free stuff? And, you know, most of the time people do. So I'm like, all right, I'll have Brian on my show. And he couldn't for personal reasons. But, you know, but I think I put it out on Twitter. I'm like, anybody want to discuss this with me? I don't know who else to even reach out to who's read this. And Jonathan, you were quick to respond, and I'm like, oh, that's perfect. That's awesome. Great. And then Jonathan, I think you recommended Gregorio come on because of all the strong Lafferty influences in there. So Gregorio, I reached out to you and, you know, and that's kind of how this kind of came together. But yeah, it was just basically through word of mouth, just reviews and things like that. And it, I'm like, I love the story of Noah. And again, Declare, Tim Powers declares Noah's Ark is featured very heavily in that story. And so I'm just very intrigued by the idea of the Nephilim and like the flood and all the symbolic sort of stuff that goes along with that. And so it just was really intriguing. So, and I didn't know it would be so influenced by Ari Lafferty and Wolf when I read it, which is just a really nice touch, I think.
Yeah. I wish we had time to go full into the Lafferty part because, but that's like a whole topic of its own. Like,
yeah.
It's complex and brilliant. And you know, Brian's particular reading of him would be something to unpack. But
You guys also like Oklahanali.
I would love it if we got back together at some point in the future and we devoted an entire episode to Lafferty.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
I would love that.
The autobiographical novel might be great to discuss.
And I have Oklahanali on my shelf. I haven't read it yet, but you guys both mentioned that that's one of your favorite works by Lafferty. And I In a Green Tree, or both, or because I really. Lafferty is just one of a kind, and he's just his own. He's his own unique thing.
He's a cult phenomenon of sorts, a writer's writer. All these things to indicate his obscurity.
Yeah,
and hasn't really. He hasn't even come into his own yet in terms of literary criticism.
I'm trying to get other Catholics to read these authors because at the very least, if they're not going to be mainstream popular, I want other Catholics to at least know about them or even other Christians too to know about these guys and at least attempt to read them and have some appreciation, even if they don't fall in love with their books, like just to be aware of them and to know that they're out there. Because part of it, I was getting sick of hearing about there's no like, oh, what happened to the Catholic literary world? And I'm like, well, I'll just move to genre fiction. mostly. I mean, some of it did. So
I put a blurb from Gene Wolfe on the front cover of Lafferty's In a Green Tree. Lafferty's our most original writer. In fact, he may be not just ours, but the most original in the history of literature. Just both one of the highest compliments I've ever seen, and also the kiss of death. He's so original. He's so quirky. He's so unique. You're probably not going to enjoy him.
No, yeah, right. You're not going to know what's going on at all. Yeah, it's.
We should definitely discuss him. I think he was must have been close to geographically close to Wolf at some point because Wolf was in Texas.
They mostly. Converse via letters. They have a lot of letters.
Yeah. Okay.
Occasionally, they would meet. They would end up at the same science fiction conventions.
Okay. Like so they did. They did meet.
They did meet, and when Wolf first started out in the late '60s, early '70s in SF, he looked towards Lafferty for inspiration. He greatly admired him, and then there's sort of. But he was Wolf was very obscure at this point. He was just a young guy starting out, and their trajectory sort of. Met at some point, and then they went in way different directions. So by the late 70s, early 80s, Wolf was winning awards. He was becoming very well known in science fiction, whereas Lafferty, no mainstream New York publisher would touch any of his new novels with a 10-foot pole.
Yeah.
And he went into a period where everything went out of print and nobody was talking about him. And so Wolf kind of made it his own project to sort of talk Lafferty up, call attention to him, and he wrote a couple of introductions to these very obscure books that by that point Lafferty could only be published by these tiny presses or even by just amateurs in their own home. I mean, one of Lafferty's greatest achievements is a trilogy of books which is now called the Argo Cycle, and he found a trucker in Canada who was a fan of his work. And the trucker used the money that he was, earning driving a truck to, publish the Argo Cycle in tiny, almost homemade editions. And they went out into the world, and they're almost impossible to find. But that just goes to show you just how obscure Lafferty had become.
By that point. Wow. Yeah.
Copyright issues and all kinds of stuff. Hard to get him back into print, too, I think.
I know Neil Gaiman has the rights to his works, right, Gregorio?
No, he doesn't, but he negotiated when when Lafferty died, he had no children, he had no immediate family, and it looked like his extended family really didn't care about his literary legacy, and they weren't going to do anything to try to preserve it or to bring it back into print. So Neil Gaiman came up with the idea as, well, let's have the science fiction, WOCUS, the Science Fiction Writers Association, buy the rights from the family, and at least with Gaiman, who's part of the organization, and other writers who admire Lafferty, there might be a chance that they could influence some publishers to bring Lafferty back. And to their credit, the really big success have been The Best of R.A. Lafferty.
Yeah, that just came out a couple years ago. Yeah,
which has introductions and by many.
Yeah, he's always introduced by a contemporary author. Yeah, that is pretty well done. But there's just so much material, and
there's 10 unpublished novels, about 15 unpublished short stories, and so I and some friends spent about 5 years negotiating with WOCUS to see if they would give us the rights to do In a Green Tree.
Okay, yeah.
Well, mostly because it's so huge, it's so weird, it's so obscure that even WOCUS didn't think it could interest any mainstream publisher into actually doing it. And we basically said, yeah, we're so amateurish, so crazy, so fanatical.
Well, I'm excited to read it. I want to dig into it. So yeah. When would that be available? I know when we talked last time, you were still kind of putting it all together, but I see it now. It's a physical copy.
So I got to basically what WOCUS sent us was a PDF like a 1500 page manuscript type written in his in Lafferty's manual typewriter. Which would be, and he got older, and his eyesight got worse, and his typewriter broke more and more down as it went along. It became weirder and harder to read, and then at some point he just went to like handwriting, and he has this really crabby, weird handwriting. So I decided to go ahead and transcribe all those 1,500 pages into a Word document. That took me a while.
Wow, what a monumental labor. That's really incredible.
Then I had to teach myself how to lay out books and typography and printing. So I went ahead and did that. And then I found a publisher and I asked them to do sort of like a test printing just to see what the heck the book was going to look like. I never published a book before. and going through it, it still has, it needs to be probably type proofed one more time.
Okay.
Which is that. And another huge thing that's sort of holding me back. Let's see if I can show you. Yeah. So look at this wonderful afterword. This is the afterword where Lafferty is put in his historical and literary and theological context so that people who actually somehow managed to get through all 800 pages will have some kind of guidepost at the end, okay?
For those who can't see it, it's blank.
To be written.
Yeah, that's the last time we spoke about this, that's what you said. You were asked to do an afterword, and that's
I tried to avoid it by asking Andrew Ferguson, who's been writing a biography of Lafferty for the last 10 years, and has read all his letters and had, tracked down every manuscript. And basically, he's, world-renowned authority, the only world-renowned authority on Lafferty's life. And he's been, I don't know if his life, if his biography is ever going to get published at the rate he's gone. But I asked him if he would write the afterword, and he's gone back and forth and hasn't appeared yet. So I'm biting the bullet, and I'm currently writing the afterword and so forth.
Wow. That's a lot of labor.
Yeah, man. That's
a thankless task in so many ways that you put into it, but incredibly admirable. And you can tell, Aaron, that like Lafferty is just a tar baby in terms of like trying to deal with his. I mean, well, you think of Christopher Tolkien spending decades trying to get his father's, and he's the son of the guy, and
right?
He has all that at his disposal,
right?
And it took him forever to get that all straightened out. And Lafferty doesn't have any direct.
I know, like, that's crazy. Yeah, but yeah, so. Wow. Well, that's so we all look forward to that.
I promised Aaron, and I promised you, Jonathan, separately, And as soon as I had a copy out that I thought was, you know, free of typos and at least relatively free of typos and looked good and so forth, and I would send both of you guys a copy of the book. You'd be the first two people that would actually get a copy of the book.
That's an honor. Thank you.
And I'm doing that because I would love to have, of course, Aaron have me back on the show to talk about the book. But I'd also love, at some point, I would love to have Jonathan's reaction to the book. If you'd like to just talk about it, or if you'd like to go to the next step and do some sort of formal book review or something like that.
I would love to. Yeah, definitely. As soon as it's available, I'll try to engage with it. I don't have, that biographer's expertise with Lafferty, of course, but like you say, he's probably the only guy in the world who does. But I've read everything of Lafferty that I can, that I've been able to get my hands on over the years. Very incredibly distinctive author. Any chance to try and help his work get into a little wider circulation recognition would be greatly welcomed by me. Like you said, Aaron, he's not going to become like a best-selling author for all kinds of reasons, not even just the nature of the writing itself. But anyway, I gotta go. Go get my kids.
I should get going too. But thank you, guys. Thanks for coming. This has been a lot of fun.
Much. Yeah.
No, thanks. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of I Might Believe in Fairies. Please leave a rating and review wherever you listen to podcasts. Please follow me on Twitter at Aaron Erber and like me on Facebook. If you are excited to see where the podcast is going and want to offer some support for the project, you can find me on Patreon. Music is by Alexander Nakarada, and podcast art was designed by my wonderful sister-in-law, Linnea Kisby. Until next time, talk to you soon.